And with that, again, welcome to Rods and More. I apologize, it was a typo there, but this is Rods and More. You are in the right place. And I guess that's it. So let's get this wonderful webinar started. Oh, I forgot one other thing. I apologize. So again, this is number 2 of 11 webinars, and this is Rods and More at Federal Facilities today, March 25th. And these are the rest of the webinars that will be available for the rest of the year, and you can register for these. And again, there's a delay in the slide, so I apologize. So if you are able to complete all the webinars, whether it's live virtual like now, or go back and look at the archive and fill out the appropriate survey and question, and you attend a in-person 3-day course or the online 3-day course, you are eligible to receive the certificate. But please keep in mind that the 3-day course is only for those that are employees of the EPA, other federal agencies connected with cleanup and state organizations. And so we'll try this again. With that, welcome to the second series in the webinar, Federal Facility Academy, Records of Decision and More at Federal Facilities. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Rashmi.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to welcome you all to this ROD webinar, and I'm just going to go off camera. Just wanted to say hello. So the purpose of this course is to discuss how different types of decision documents can be used at federal facility Superfund sites that are listed on the National Priorities List. This is in accordance with CERCLA, which stands for the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Acts. We will also discuss removal actions, post-ROD decisions, and how 5-year reviews impacts remedies on sites as well. So, just wanted we presented ourselves, the host, and again, I'm from headquarters. We wanted to give a headquarters perspective, and then Jenna is a federal facility RPM. And Aaron Meraz is a private site RPM. So we kind of wanted to give a the perspective from the regional point of view as well. So I want to thank them. So at this time, we just wanted to get an idea of what kind of experience the audience has. So I'm going to ask JR if he could release the poll for everyone to to respond to the poll. That would be awesome.
The poll is released.
Thanks, JR. If you guys can respond to the poll, just to get an idea of experience of, what type of experience people have in reviewing or writing decision documents.
Okay, the results are starting to come in. We're approaching 50%, and looks like a lot of people have experience with ROD. Removal action seems to be what is trending right now.
Awesome.
We're getting cl close to 75%.
Thanks. That sounds great.
And I will be closing in 3, 2, 1. I'm closing the poll now, and I'm sharing the results.
So it
Everyone.
looks like there's a lot of removal actions. People have done, which is great. And then pretty fair amount doing record of decisions. Awesome. Thank you. Thanks so much, JR. Appreciate that. Gene, okay, got it. It's a little slow. Sorry, guys. So I wanted to kind of go over what we will be covering. I will be covering CERCLA process at FUDFACS NPL sites and how headquarters supports actually how that we can be helpful in regards to either reviewing or writing decision documents. Jenna will be covering removal actions and post-rod decisions, while Aaron will be covering rods and 5-year reviews and those impacts on decision documents. I am going to start with the CERCLA process at federal facility NPL sites. So I wanted to start with an introduction to CERCLA. CERCLA in 1980, Congress enacted CERCLA, which is also commonly known as a Superfund program. And it authorizes the president to respond to releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances into the environment. Congress then amended the CERCLA through the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act in 1986 to strengthen CERCLA. And CERCLA's major emphasis is on the cleanup of inactive hazardous waste sites and the liability for cleanup cost on arrangers and transportators of hazardous substances, and also on current and former owners of facilities where hazardous substances were disposed of. CERCLA gives the president authority to clean up these sites under requirements generically referred to as removal or remedial provisions, and the National Oil and Hazardous Substance Pollution Contingency Plan, which is NCP for short, outlines CERCLA's implementing both these removal and remedial actions. Agencies must follow the procedures and standards that are detailed in the NCP when they are remediating these Superfund sites. There's also the Executive Order 12580, which delegates the presidential authorities under CERCLA to heads of various executive branch agencies or other federal agencies that have created the contamination. Examples include Department of War and Department of Energy. And in these instances, they are the lead agencies at Superfund site cleanups, while EPA provides oversight. And this is all in accordance with the site-specific federal facility agreements. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the definition of lead agency. And the National Oil and Hazardous Substance Pollution Contingency Plan also states the cases where another federal agency besides EPA serves as the lead agency. That other federal lead agency is the agency that will provide the on-scene coordinator for removal actions, and for remedial actions, it will be the remedial project manager. In addition to the lead agency staff, you will have the EPA Federal Facility RPM, the state project officer, and usually there's a contractor or the lead agency that supports the cleanup. So they all kind of work in a team. In the case of a release of hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminants where the release is on or where the source of the release is from any federal facility or vessel under the jurisdiction, custody, or control of another federal agency, again, an example is Department of War, Department of Energy. They will be the lead agency and they will conduct the remedial or removal actions. There is another scenario as well where a state or political subdivision of a state operating under a cooperative agreement or under a Superfund memorandum of agreement may also be the lead for a response action. So I wanted to cover this is CERCLA 120, which is very important for federal facilities. So, in addition to making federal facilities subject to the same CERCLA mandates that apply to private sites under Superfund, Section 120 imposes additional requirements on federal facilities. CERCLA also contains what is called a waiver of sovereign immunity to permit individuals and states to bring citizen suits if a lead agency is not adhering to a CERCLA mandate. In addition to the waiver of sovereign immunity, the EPA administrator has final say over a remedy selection. And the lead agency does document the remedy selection decision in a record of decision, but it requires approval by EPA under CERCLA. So the NCP which again stands for National Contingency Plan, is a regulatory framework, and it acts as a blueprint for CERCLA. It gives step-by-step processes for conducting a removal and remedial actions in Superfund sites, and we've included the web link below here. So take a look at it. It's very detailed, and it's we've included that web link for your review. I wanted to go over the overall CERCLA remedial process on a Superfund site. So the first step includes listing a site, which is called a preliminary assessment site inspection. And in this, there's a hazardous rank system, and if it scores high enough, it goes on to the national priorities list. So it is a Superfund site. So once that happens, either a removal action, which again, an on-scene coordinator would do, if there's a really immediate threat that can be conducted, or a remedial cleanup, where there's a whole line of steps that I'm going to go through in a remedial cleanup. So the first step in a remedial cleanup is a remedial investigation feasibility study. And in the remedial investigation, what happens is a delineation is done of what the contamination is and where that contamination is. And this is like a multimedia investigation. Then the feasibility study looks at cleanup options for each media and will go into a risk assessment and then have a preferred remedy. So once the remedial investigation feasibility study is done, then you go on to the decision document. So you start off with a proposed plan. And again, in that, there's a whole line of, there's a risk assessment and information as far as a preferred remedy. And then the major thing with a proposed plan is that there's a public comment period and a public meeting where the remedy is discussed, what the preferred remedy is, and it's really to get community input on the preferred remedy. So if all goes well in regards to the public comments, then the next step is to do a record of decision, which lays out again the preferred remedy. There are some legal errors that are also listed in the record of decision, but this is the actual legal document in regards to the cleanup. So once a record of decision is completed, and also there's a responsiveness summary at the end of this decision document that outlines all the public comments and responses. So once a ROD is completed, then you go into the remedial design for the preferred cleanup. And then the remedial action is the actual on-site construction for that cleanup. So once that is done, you have a 5-year reviews that are statutory reviews that kind of show if the remedy is still protective. So that is done if there's waste in place. There's also policy 5-year reviews, and I think this is going to be covered later on, so I'm not going to go into detail. There's also an O&M, which you're collecting a lot of groundwater data, you're ensuring the caps are okay, is protective. And then the last step is really if all the operable units meet the remedial action objectives in each decision document for the site, APA has to sign off on this, and a site can be deleted from an NPL. The other quick thing I want to mention is that there's when there are major changes or minor changes to a decision document, this can be an explanation of significant difference or a record of decision. And we're going to go into that later on in the presentation. So now I want to talk about how headquarters can be helpful on at federal facility sites when you're dealing with decision documents. So there's a lot of resources that are available online, and so there's again, we had listed the NCP and the web link that kind of goes into specific information for remedial and removal actions. And really, the best EPA guidance is this 1999 ROD guidance. You can click the link and go to it, but it is a very detailed guidance that talks about what should be in a proposed plan, what sections are there, what should be in a ROD, what should be in an explanation of significant difference, a ROD amendment. amendment? How are they different? How is an ESD different from a Rodd Amendment? There's checklists, which I think I'm going to go into the next slide. And headquarters has templates as well that kind of make it easy in Word, kind of specifying what the required sections are with important information as far as what should be in each section. So those are the templates, and those are the Rodd and proposed builders. There's also the Superfund implementation SPIM, which kind of goes over measures, specific measures for each remedial process. And then there's a Superfund Remedy Decisions webpage. There's a lot of good information on decision documents. And then I'm going to go into who the headquarters federal facility regional coordinators are on the next slide. Any questions you may have on decision documents or five-year reviews, please feel free to reach out to them. And then for EPA and state staff, there's the National Association of Remedial Project Manager Training, which may happen in the future. And in that training, there are specific courses that are on writing RODs and writing remedial action objectives for decision documents. So a lot of good information. I listed all, each region has a specific headquarters federal facility regional coordinator. So I've listed them on the slide. Feel free to email them if you have a question again on decision documents or five-year reviews in your particular region. They're there to help. So there's very specific checklist. Again, the 1999 guidance document is very, very helpful. There's again proposed plan and ROD checklist. I had mentioned, how is an explanation of significant difference different from a ROD amendment? So that's really helpful. There's also if your supervisor, when they're looking at a decision document, what they should be looking for. And it goes into the different types of records of decisions and how they can be used: no action rods, interim action rods, contingency decision documents. And we will be going into these different types later on in the presentation. So I wanted to really quickly touch upon when you are reviewing or writing a decision document, it is very important for folks to be reviewing the ROD, so you have the lead agency's RPM. Their supervisor may look at it. There's technical support if there's groundwater, having the hydro look at it, having the site attorney look at the ARRs are very important. The state also has a project manager, and they will have to concur with the remedy, and they may have their supervisor or technical support look at it as well. And then the EPA RPM as well. They have their technical support, risk assessors, hydro, and then additionally their attorneys. So it's really important so that the decision document is in good shape for these levels of review. I just wanted to mention for federal facilities, there are some required consultations that I wanted to just kind of identify. If a remedy is over $100 million, that is a required consultation. If there are ARR waivers, for instance, a technical impractical waiver for groundwater, that is a consultation. M&A, PFAS, RAD, and IC-only remedies are another reason for consultation. Any decision documents dealing with munitions is a consultation as well, and then residential lead and 5-year reviews for statutory reviews, that is a required consultation at headquarters. So reach out to your federal facility coordinators if you have any questions on those particular items. So I wanted to kind of just mention that all removal actions along with remedial actions kind of work hand in hand together, and then 5-year reviews really ensure that the remedies are protective, and if there has to be any revisions, there may be some ESDs and ROD amendments. So they all kind of work together to ensure the remedy is still protective. So I think that's it for my portion. Are there any questions? I'm gonna open it up for questions for myself right now on from headquarters.
Hey, Rashmi. So on slide 10, two questions came up. This looks like the same process for all Superfund sites. What is unique in the flow chart on slide 10 for federal facilities? And then the additional question was, when do 5-year reviews stop?
Can you go to slide 10 so I can look at it? Or let's see. Okay, because I can't remember what it was. Okay, so sorry. Now, can you ask the question, please?
This looks like the same process for all Superfund sites. What is unique in the flow chart on slide 10 for federal facilities?
So for federal facilities, what happens is the lead agency, which is the other federal lead agency, is the one who is writing the record of decision. So the EPA remedial project manager will be reviewing that decision document and giving input. And on private sites, as far as or fund on fund lead sites, especially with fund lead sites, the EPA RPM with an EPA contractor would be actually writing the decision document. On a PRP site, the PRP's contractor would probably be giving a draft of the decision document for EPA approval. So that's kind of how it's different. So the federal facility sites, the EPA RPM will be reviewing that the decision document. Does that answer your question? And then
When do 5-year reviews
review.
stop?
So 5 year. So we have more information later on in the presentation, but a policy. So there's the policy 5-year reviews, and there's a statutory 5-year reviews. If there is waste in place, even if a site is deleted from the NPL, the 5-year reviews will continue because there's as long as there's waste in place, they will continue. So they pretty much go for as long as that waste is in place. Aaron, do you have any more input on that? Just because you're
No, I mean, I think you got it right with the 5-year views. They stop if waste in place, they keep going. They will stop if all cleanup standards have been met and it's UUUE, unlimited use, unlimited exposure. So there's a chance they can stop in certain instances.
Okay, awesome.
Do you have time for one more question? Do you want to transition to the next slides?
I don't know, Jean, do we have time for more questions?
Well,
Or, and I,
I think we
yeah,
should move
sorry.
on just in the interest of time.
Okay, and I can respond to the questions afterwards, just FYI. Next, as I will turn it over to Jenna.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just waiting for the slides to reverse back to the first. There we go, introduction. All right. So thanks, Rashmi, for that great presentation. I'm going to talk about removal actions. And on this slide are the learning objectives for this module. So the first module, our first objective is to distinguish what constitute an emergency versus time critical versus non-time critical removal action and when those can be used. Secondly, understand how the NCP governs removals and how CERCLA Section 120 applies to federal facilities. Know key decision documents, public participation, and compliance requirements, and recognize federal facilities' specific roles, agreements, and pitfalls. So response actions at federal facilities generally involve multiple media, contaminants, and land areas. Therefore, addressing cleanup requires the use of multiple types of actions and strategies. Priority should be given to addressing the presence of principal threat waste and ongoing releases and conditions posing an imminent threat of endangerment. One of the CERCLA tools that can be used for high priority environmental problems warranting actions is removals. I am including links here to EPA guidance on using one type of removal action, the non-time critical removal action, because of all three types, this one requires the most documentation and has the most requirements. In addition to removal actions, early actions, interim remedial actions, and final remedial actions can all be used to achieve cleanup. Often, a short-term action is designated to address an immediate threat to health or the environment. All of the requirements for implementing a removal action can be found in 40 CFR Section 300.415. And as I said, removals are short-term actions generally, but they can also be long-term actions as well. And as Rashmi mentioned earlier, Executive Order 12580 authorizes CERCLA authority to federal agencies. So the goal of these removal actions is not only to address high-priority threats, but also to accelerate cleanup to the extent practicable and when appropriate, and to contribute to the efficient performance of any anticipated long-term remedial actions. At federal facilities, if the lead agency proposes to take a removal action rather than to wait for selection of a remedial action in a record of decision, such proposals should be sufficiently justified as appropriate and protective. This is because the evaluation process and documentation requirements for removals are much less rigorous than what is required for remedial actions. And the decision to select a removal alternative and take action does not require regulator approval. So the premise for agreeing to conduct a removal action is that the lead agency has identified reasons why conducting a removal rather than just proceeding with continuing the remedial process is sufficiently justified and appropriate. As Rashmi discussed earlier, CERCLA Section 120 requires EPA to enter into federal facility agreements with the lead agencies listed on the National Priorities List. And this is done to ensure that cleanups are protective and completed in a timely manner. Under federal facility agreements and in accordance with Section 120, EPA expects early notification of proposed investigations and identification of problems warranting CERCLA action, joint scoping, and for removals, cooperation in working towards agreement on whether the removal action is an emergency, a time-critical, or a non-time-critical action. Additionally, under Section 120, federal agencies must comply to the same extent as any non-governmental entity. Additional commitments are also included in the federal facility agreement, which all of the FFA parties who signed that agreement must adhere to. For example, federal facility agreements should document which areas at a site are subject to CERCLA, specify schedules and dates, and required deliverables that will be needed to implement the cleanup. These dates and requirements are referred to as milestones and are generally designated for each area and site identified as warranting a CERCLA action. All parties to the FFA, including the lead agency, EPA, and the state, must agree on the milestones, with the regulators having approval authority subject to dispute resolution. If disputes arise, EPA can elevate these disputes to management and, if needed, use FFA enforcement tools to keep work on schedule and within the agreed scope. A note here about FFA milestones. I think it's important to talk a little bit about why establishing milestones for CERCLA work at federal facilities, which includes for removal and remedial actions, is so important. An FFA is a legally binding agreement. As such, the establishment of milestone dates accomplishes kind of five main objectives. The first is to make sure the cleanup is enforceable. It turns vague obligations into specific deadlines, allows regulators to hold the facility accountable by triggering enforcement actions or penalties if milestones are missed. It keeps complex projects moving. Cleanups involve many steps, including both remedial and removal processes. An establishment of milestones provides manageable, trackable phases that can help prevent bottlenecks between agencies and contractors and helps to coordinate the multiple stakeholders. Third, it creates transparency. It gives the public a clear timeline of what's happening at the site and allows communities and regulators to track whether commitments are being met. It supports credibility, and regulators can also have an easy format to follow that shows when commitments are supposed to be completed and whether they're being met. And fourth, it drives funding and resource planning, and this is critical to any project. It helps justify and sequence the funding requests, aligns the cleanup work with annual budget cycles, and ensures the contractors and staff are available when needed. In other words, no defined schedule equals poor funding equals delays to the project. And fifth and last, it reduces the legal and program risk. Missed or undefined timelines can lead to disputes, increased cost of the project, delays, and ultimately frustration on everyone's part. There we go. So we'll talk about EPA's role specifically in removals at federal facilities. EPA reviews the action memorandum for time-critical removal actions and non-time-critical removal actions. The action memo is the decision document that selects the removal alternative to be implemented, much like a ROD selects a remedial action. In addition, if the removal is a non-time critical action, EPA reviews the NCTRA required engineering evaluation and cost analysis document, which is analogous to a proposed plan in the remedial process. ECAs are not required for time critical removals or emergency removals, only for non-time critical. But action memos are required for both non-time critical actions and time critical because they are the decision document that has the information about what actions being taken and why. EPA is also responsible for communicating the agency's findings about whether proposed removal actions are believed to be protective, consistent with the NCP, and compliant with ARARS to the extent practical, including all chemical-specific, location-specific, and action-specific requirements. However, because removal actions are generally not the final action, some ARARS may not be able to be fully complied with, and this is okay as long as they are addressed in the final remedial action. EPA also supports the lead agency in facilitating coordination with states, tribes, and the public. Role also includes oversight, review of removal action work plans, sampling and analysis plans, quality assurance project plans, any data that's generated with the project, and may also include things such as conducting site visits, collecting split or confirmatory samples, verifying data quality, and assessing the action's protectiveness. Note that under the NCP, EPA retains approval authority of SAPs, sampling analysis plans, but does not have approval authority for the action memo. However, if you are working with a federal facility that has an FFA, you should check the federal facility agreement to see what it states about EPA's approval of SAPs or the state's regulator approval of SAPs. For instance, even though under the NCP, the regulations specify that EPA has regulator approval of SAPs. For one federal facility, Oak Ridge Reservation, the FFA says that the sampling analysis plan are secondary documents and therefore not subject to EPA approval. So make sure you really know your FFA agreements inside and out. Under the National Response System, The interface for emergencies is that the pre-designated federal on-scene coordinator coordinates the response under the NCP. So a federal facility may conduct emergency actions with its own OSC, but EPA's OSC retains coordination and oversight authority and can direct efforts where necessary to abate imminent and substantial endangerment. EPA may take independent response action or issue orders if necessary to address an imminent and substantial endangerment where the lead agency is not responding timely or appropriately. However, in reality, most often if there's disagreements about response, those are worked out in a tri-party agreement through negotiations and discussion using the FFA. So EPA is also, it's important that they provide input to the lead agency, that they are abiding by all community and stakeholder involvement requirements. And these are laid out in 40 CFR section 300.832. We'll talk a little more about this later on. Additionally, if hazardous substances remain at levels that do not allow unlimited use and unrestricted exposure, which is often the case because they're usually followed with remedial action, the lead agency must conduct five-year reviews, including at areas where removals were conducted. EPA is also responsible for verifying that any institutional controls, long-term monitoring, and any other post-removal operations and maintenance requirements are maintained to ensure the protectiveness of the site. In summary, EPA's oversight aims to ensure that removal actions led by other federal agencies are timely, protective, and consistent with CERCLA and the NCP. And EPA accomplishes this by working through the FFA to coordinate with the lead agency, provide rigorous technical reviews of information and decision documents, ensuring the ARARs are being identified and met to the maximum extent practical for removals, ensuring appropriate community involvement, offsite disposal requirements are met, and any field execution, data quality, and schedules and overall quality are being met. So now I'm going to talk more specifically about the different types of removal actions. The emergency removals are, as stated, require an immediate response to releases or threatened releases and are initiated usually within hours or days of the determination that a removal action is appropriate. Time-critical removals are generally completed when a removal is appropriate and on-site removal activities must begin within 6 months. And again, the action memo documents the selection of the removal action. And then non-time-critical removals are undertaken when a removal action is appropriate and the situation allows for planning for a period of at least 6 months or greater before on-site activities must begin. And as I mentioned, the engineering evaluation and cost analysis, which is essentially like a proposed plan, is a requirement for these types of removals. And then once the removal action has been determined, an action memo is written documenting the selection of that action. So the action memo, as I said, was the primary decision document. And this slide just lists the required items that must be included in such a document. EPA does have a policy of accelerating CERCLA environmental restorations, and this slide refers to the EPA guidance that provides that information. The purpose of this guidance is to encourage and support efforts at federal facilities to accelerate and develop streamlined approaches for cleanup of hazardous waste. This policy was signed jointly by EPA, the Department of War, and the Department of Energy in 1994. Let me talk just a little bit about sampling analysis plans with respect to removals. Under environmental related removal actions, EPA should review and approve SAPs for environmental actions. As I said earlier, though, please check your FFAs because they may have additional requirements or different expectations when it comes to these types of requirements. And as we all know, there's several EPA guidance documents pertaining to what's required in sampling analysis plans and quality assurance project plans. And when it comes to federal facilities, I'm sure most of you are aware that there is a guidance out there that's called the Uniform Federal Policy Act for quality assurance project plans. However, I really wanted to mention that in 2023, EPA came out with a new QAP guidance, and it's this EPA IT/IM directive standard, quality assurance project plan standard that you'll see on your slide is highlighted in red. This standard includes everything that's been previously identified in EPA guidance, but it adds an additional component that is now required, and that is all environmental information operations must be addressed by the QAP. So not just sampling and analysis. This includes things such as if you have a model that produces data that feeds into your decision about what the environmental problems warranting action are, or what actions to take, that should be included in your QAP. Also, if you have any kind of statistical data or process knowledge information or calculations that somehow support the overall information about your site, those should be covered by your quality assurance project plan. And that's what this EPA standard does. And just a note on that too, if you just Googled the 2023 EPA QAP standard, it will bring that standard right up, and you can view it for yourself. All right, so let's talk about time critical actions. Often referred to as TICRAs. TICRAs are completed when there's less than 6 months of planning before the on-site activity must occur. Sorry, my slide is lagging there. And then a notice of availability of the action memo stating what action will be taken must be placed in an administrative record file and be placed in a major media outlet or other online resource so that the public can access it. This must be done within 60 days of initiation of the on-site removal activity. There must be a public comment period for at least 30 days, and if there's substantial comments, a responsiveness summary must be prepared. If on-site work is to extend beyond 120 days or 6 months, the regulations also state that a community involvement plan should be established and maintained in the repository. And also, a community involvement coordinator should be appointed in order to coordinate any responses and respond to questions or inquiries. The items that must be included in an action memo, which is the concise written record of the removal action selection, include these items listed here, which are site background, threat determination, objectives and scope, alternatives considered, the selected action, the cost estimate, any statutory limits, community involvement, the off-site rule of compliance, the expected duration of the action, the consistency with the anticipated future remedial action, any institutional controls that must be applied or post-removal site controls, and all of this must be placed in the administrative record file. Completion of the time-critical removal action. There must be a closeout report. And it will be needed to ensure that the transition to the remedial action is consistent and comprehensive in manner. Typically, the remedial action completion or removal action completion has to be reviewed and approved by the regulators. And now, just to talk quickly about non-time critical removal actions. The NCP states that whenever a planning period of at least 6 months, as we stated before, exists before on-site activities must be initiated, and the lead agency determines, based on a site evaluation, that removal is appropriate, the lead agency shall conduct an engineering evaluation and cost analysis. This includes data collected as part of the investigation and documents the evaluation of the removal alternatives for implementing the responses, similar to a feasibility study and proposed plan. And then just to follow up here, so the initial evaluation is often documented as a removal site evaluation. And then in this removal site evaluation, there is a set defined set of evaluation criteria that must be considered, and the ARARs must also be evaluated. The ECA will define the removal action objectives and the scope, identify the range of alternatives, identify all ARARs, and evaluate the alternatives using three criteria: effectiveness, implementability, and cost. It selects the removal alternative, documents the basis for selection, discusses the threats addressed, the ARARs that will be met, the estimated cost, any statutory limits, consistency with the future remedial action, and as said, again, any institutional controls or post-removal control needs. The public participation requirements include a 30-day public notice and comment period, the establishment of a repository to include the administrative record file, and to hold a public meeting if there is sufficient interest. It's not necessarily required, but encouraged if there is significant public involvement and interest in the site. And then, of course, for any comments, a responsiveness summary must be provided. And at the end of that, then the action memo is written, which documents the selection of the decision and is again made available to the public. So in 1995, EPA and the Department of Energy wrote a joint policy memo, which established an approach for decommissioning surplus Department of Energy facilities consistent with CERCLA that achieves risk reduction without unnecessary delay. For purposes of this policy, decommissioning includes those activities that take place after a facility has been deactivated. And then this is sort of unique because Department of Energy facilities have usually this added component of dealing with high radiation facilities. So deactivation, which occurs before decommissioning, is the process of placing a facility in a safe and stable condition that is protective of workers, the public, and the environment until the decommissioning can be completed. As the bridge between operations and decommissioning, deactivation can accomplish operations-like activities such as completing final process runs, performing some decontamination, and in some instances, such as for nuclear reactors, this phase can be known as making the facility cold and dark, referring to the removal and/or stabilization and deactivation of radiological material and operations. The decommissioning that follows and the dismantlement are what's considered generally part of the CERCLA process. So, in general terms, the deactivation is sort of pre-CERCLA, although there can be components of that where the regulators are involved. And so, again, you should check your FFA and you should talk to your federal partners about plans they have for deactivation and decommissioning and how that fits into the CERCLA action. And that concludes my discussion on removals, and I'll turn it over to Aaron for his talk on records of decisions.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. And I'll actually address some of the questions that are coming up and kind of gain some time back. So moving on to record of decisions, and this is a type of decision document. Think about a decision document. It's the ROD, the ESD, the memo to file. It documents some sort of cleanup. So some of the other stuff, like a feasibility study, a type memo, that's not a decision document. An example of a good decision document is pretty much any one I write. Just kidding, but the best way to know if it's a good decision document is if it is following the 1999 ROD guidance, even though it's an oldie. It's a really good one. So as an RPM, when I'm writing that, and you'll keep hearing me talk about it, having that 1999 ROD guidance as you're working through the ROD, or in even in throughout the RAFS phase, is a good thing to do because it's items that you're gonna have to cover. And one another thing you'll hear me talk about, and I'm gonna keep referencing, is the CFR, the NCP, and just looking at that, where it is, because that's what the regulators are following from on the EPA side, is what are we on in the NCP? And you go to ecfr.gov and kind of 40 and find the NCP so you can get an up-to-date version. And really, the purpose of a ROD is it's a legal document that certifies the remedy selection process was carried out in accordance with CERCLA to the extent practical in the National Contingency Plan. Also, the substantive summary of the technical rationale and background information contained in the administrative record file. Also, it's a technical document that provides information necessary for determining the conceptual engineering components and which outlines the remedial action objectives and cleanup levels for that selected remedy. And it's a key communication tool for the public that explains the contamination problems and the remedy that seeks to address the rationale for its selection. And kind of just, I want to kind of go back and just a reminder as you're going through that RIFS, because it all leads into the record of decision, it's the focus. Part of it is to focus on what you're doing is you're collecting the data to make that decision. And two references here are from the one is from the NCP and another is from the RAFS guidance that just highlights that is the one of the main portions of the remedial investigation, or maybe even the most important part, is you're collecting data so you can make a decision to clean up an issue and identifying an issue that you have to clean up and then cleaning it up. Oops, sorry, clicked it twice. And then the feasibility study, the next little part that I'll just go back to, you're really just looking at what are the alternatives that we're looking at. That was not me, but let me get you back to the slide. The feasibility study, you're evaluating the potential alternatives that you're going to use to then be selected. And that is going to be the basis for the proposed plan and the record of decision. So as I kind of move forward, and it's into the ROD, but realize a lot of this information is stuff you're going to want to consider as the feasibility is either being drafted or reviewed, of where you're most likely to address the comments is up front. Because once it's already going to, if you're draft, when the ROD is being written, it's already gone through a public comment period. There's always been review, so there's not going to be much changed from the what alternatives you're looking at or anything like that, unless there's something fundamentally wrong or that was missed. And then kind of just moving in through the Superfund process, proposed plan. Just something to remember. Like you can kind of move forward at different times. And the ROD guidance goes into it that there are ways to start it earlier in the process. And really, it's whether there is that basis of action. Does the site say you can actually start moving forward in a proposed plan? And realize with through the remedial investigation and the feasibility study, you're collecting information that is going to be used to support the decision that's going to document why the ROD is signed. So that is getting acquired throughout the process, and the lead agency shall establish an administrative record that contains the documents that form that basis of selection and response action. It's updated when the proposed plan is out for public comment. So this way, the public can review the documents that the lead agency and the EPA use and the state use to make that decision. And then it's updated again when the ROD is signed. And this highlight is kind of getting right into the ROD guidance. And you'll notice a lot of times I'll take right from here. It's a recommended outline for how a record of decision should be written. A few of the key items that I'm going to highlight is just in the blue to the right. Sorry, just need to drink some water. So the basis of action, there's four things to say. Is there something we have to clean up? And those are it, and you're going to have to trigger that to perform a to get to a ROD. Is there a risk there? Is there a release of or substantial threat of release of hazardous substance into the environment or pollutant or contaminant, which that may present an imminent or substantial danger to public health or welfare? Is there an unacceptable risk? That's the above 10 to the negative 4 from a carcinogenic risk or above HI of 1. So that's kind of the baseline human health risk assessment. Will that trigger it? Or from the ecological standpoint, from the SLARA or the FARA, is there an adverse environmental impact? And then lastly, it's the exceedance of chemical specific standards or other measures that define acceptable risk levels. And that's kind of the your drinking water standards can trigger a action. And then kind of responding to the one of the items that you're going to want to when you're looking at a if you're writing a ROD or reviewing a ROD or looking at there's certain language that is there in the 1999 ROD guidance that is required to be in the decision documents. And this one highlight 612 depends on if it's a CERCLA hazardous substance or it's a pollutant or contaminant. And the CERCLA hazardous substances are written defined in the NCP, and that's in 40 CFR 302.4. And it lists them all. It was updated over the last few years when PFOA and PFOS were added as CERCLA hazardous substances. Remedial Act objectives, another little NCP reference, and they're all defined right through the NCP. But the lead agency shall establish remedial action objectives for the contaminants of concern that you're addressing, the media that it's addressing, potential exposure pathway, and the remediation goal. For a little more information, you've heard this a lot already. It's the ROD guidance has some. And the REOs, think of it, describes what that cleanup is going to accomplish and if it's proposed or if it is actually going to get there. And then the RAGs for the human health risk assessment has additional information on the REOs. And then kind of moving forward, remedial action objectives. In the FS and the ROD, it actually changes where we're identifying the unacceptable risk. We have a remedial action objectives that are going to be pretty much the same. But in the FS, We call it a preliminary remediation goal based on what the range of the different alternatives are. But in the ROD, when the actual remedy is selected, it becomes the cleanup level we're actually going to meet. It should be, and that's the wording that should be used in the record of decision, is a cleanup level. And that def is addressed as it addresses the remedial component. And certain words that you're going to want to hear. What's the objective? Are you preventing contact from contamination? Are you protecting from contamination? Are we restoring groundwater to beneficial use? What is that cleanup going to accomplish? You're going to minimize risk, reduce risk. Key things to factor in, focus in on as you're writing a remedial action objective or reviewing one. And kind of coming up with those remediation goals, and this gets into the ARRs and figuring out, okay, what are we actually meeting? And there's a few in the NCP and in CERCLA that says, okay, this are we going to consider this? MCLs and non-zero MCLGs, like, are we saying those are relevant and appropriate where they need to be met for beneficial use? If it's a surface water remedy, are we considering the federal ambient water quality criteria? Or if the state has a promulgated surface water criteria, is that something we're looking at? As you're coming up with these preliminary remediation goals, to consider where they're coming from, what should they be, and realize the identification of the ARR should start of at the right at the beginning of the remedial investigation phase, because you're going to figure out, okay, what are those? You should always have the idea of what are we going to get to in the end. So you're going to want to think about what those potentially could be, but realize they're only ARRs are only finalized once that ROD is signed. And then if there's multiple contaminants, will the in the FS, are there other preliminary goals? If you meet them all, are you still going to meet that, say hypothetically, that 10 to the negative 4 HI of 1 cumulative risk? Because that's your basis of action. Like, are you going to actually clean it up below a basis of action? So just all some things to consider as you're figuring out what you need to clean it up to. And then when you're picking a remedy, there's the 9 criteria. And they're separated into 3 different, and I'll kind of go into each one individually and give a little of an example. There's the threshold criteria that has to be met for overall protection of human health and the environment and the compliance with ARRs. There's the primary balancing criteria, the long-term effectiveness, the reduction of toxicity, mobility, volume, the short-term effectiveness, implementability, and cost. And the modifying criteria is state acceptance and community acceptance. And kind of just going through each one now. Overall protection of human health and the environment, kind of that's that statutory requirement. Did you address the contamination where there's not going to be any unexpected exposures and is required? So you can think you got to kind of meet this one in a ROD or it's not going to fly. Next one that also has to be met is the compliance with ARRs, and realize this is not required for just an interim action, and specific ARRs like a drinking water standard can be waived if we go through that process to determine if you can't meet that standard from a technical impracticability standpoint. And it's another regulatory requirement. So then getting into the balancing criteria, there's long-term effectiveness and permanence. And things and some of these items that I'm kind of keying on is right on that NCP, where you can kind of see exactly what I'm going into. It's the magnitude of the remaining risk and the adequacy of the controls. So give an example of this. Like if you're building a cap in a floodplain and it's only a soil cover and a floodplain, is that going to last in the long term? And the answer is no. So that might get the alternative, get you away from moving with that alternative. Next is the reduction of a toxicity, mobility, or volume through treatment. One thing when the writers were working on Circle, they just didn't want to create a bunch of different landfills everywhere and just move contamination from one thing. So toxicity, mobility, they want treatment. There is a preference for treatment. And it deals with how you're going to treat it, what chemical, like an example of this alternative and what you'd consider when you're dealing with this criteria is in a hypothetical situation, if you're doing an in situ treatment of groundwater, and one of the alternatives says you're going to inject a chemical ox chemical, is that chemical going to actually address the contaminants that are there? So short term, and the next is short term effectiveness. How's that going to affect the community? Is there going to be a lot of dust there? Can the workers, are the workers going to be safely able to implement the construction to do the cleanup? How long is it going to take? And some other factors like that. Implementability. One of those words that I didn't realize existed till I joined EPA. It's the technical ability to construct and operate the remedy. Like, is it administratively feasible? So things to think consider if this was, are you going to do a dig and haul right next to a building? Say if you're going to go down to 50 feet, are you physically going to actually be able to engineer this remedy? Is something you'll look at with an engineering, or are you going to dig right near a railroad line? Can you get that close to a rail line? Some things to consider from an implementability standpoint. And then last from the balancing criteria is cost. And then the NCP kind of says you in the prep and the rod, you got to have these three down to compare. And it's the capital cost of how much it's going to take right now to construct the remedy, to provide the cleanup. Then there's the how much is it going to annually cost from an annual operation and maintenance cost moving forward. And last is the net present value of capital and operation and maintenance. And that's where we kind of take a discount factor moving forward to determine that cost. And kind of it balances out the costs with over time and the current one. And then we get into the modifying criteria. There's the state acceptance, and realize the actual state acceptance isn't until after the public comment period closes, because the state, and this is one of the questions in there, should be reviewing, will be reviewing the prep. They're going to be reviewing the rod, and they're not going to finalize until they see that draft rod with the, hey, this is the public comments and the responsiveness summary that we received. So states should be, they have to, they should be reviewing the prep and the rod. They should also be throughout the process reviewing everything to make sure they're on board throughout the process, because you don't want to, and while rods can be signed without state acceptance, it's not in good practice and they should be in agreement. Then lastly is community acceptance. And that's why we have the public comment period, so they can provide input on the remedy, and realize with community acceptance, we're looking to see if there's something the agencies, the lead agency or EPA would say, miss from a through by following CERCLA and get their input on it. And then some things that kind of want to make sure is within the rod is how if there's principal threat waste and how it's a how it is addressed. So principal threat waste are those source materials considered to be highly toxic or highly mobile that generally can't be reliably contained or would present a significant risk to human health or the environment should exposure occur. And that's usually some like your DNAPLs, your LNAPLs. There's a 1990 EPA guidance on PCBs at Superfund sites, and they define that as if you have PCBs over 500, and it's kind of it can be very specific to the site. And then remember, we're following CERCLA, so there's the statutory determinations that we're required to be there. And if we're not following one of those, we have to present the reason why not. There's the protection to protect human health and the environment, the compliance with applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. Those two things, these are those two items in the as the first two criteria. There's the cost effectiveness. There's the preference to utilize permanent solutions and alternative treatment to the maximal extent practicable. Or there's also the preference for treatment as a principal threat element. So if there is a remedy where you're not doing treatment at some point in the statutory determinations of the rod, whoever's writing it is going to explain why the treatment is not there. I mean, and there could be a good reason of like, hey, we got this low-level bit of contamination. Treatment isn't possible, so we're just getting it to a nearby disposal facility. And then another item that is required at the end of rods is if there is a 5-year review requirement. What is the 5-year review requirement? And that is in 121C of CERCLA. And you won't see this determination in rods before SARA because Section 121 was added as part of SARA in the late 1980s. So it's what do you need a 5-year review? Is there a waste in place that you need to address, or is the waste is the contaminant is the cleanup to when before, when you meet cleanup standards going to take that long where a 5-year review is required? And then Rashmi, I think you wanted to kind of get on to the types of the rods. I'll let you.
So I wanted to kind of hit upon the different types of the rods and what the purpose is. So a no action rod means that a risk assessment concluded that there's no site risk, and this may be due to a removal or a RCRA action that was completed already. So there's no active remediation. So it's more of a passive remedy, and that could include putting land use controls or monitoring. The second type of rod I wanted to talk about was the early action rod, and this is a remedial action taken before the remedial investigation feasibility study is completed. And this could occur because you're trying to protect human health and the environment from an imminent threat in the short term, before a final remedy is being developed for the site. So, a good example is providing a temporary alternative water supply to residents prior to a remedy being selected for the groundwater later down the road. There is also interim action record of decisions, and those are more completed at separate operable units or as a component of a final rod for a site. So a interim rod must be followed by a final rod so that it is protective in the long term. And an example of that could be excavating a hot spot soil area where the contamination may be migrating to the groundwater, so that excavation for the soil is an interim remedy until a final remedy is taken for the for the groundwater. Then we have a contingency action rod, and this is more appropriate when there is significant uncertainty about the ability of a preferred remedy to achieve cleanup levels. So you may have, for instance, a groundwater remedy such as bioremediation, and you may have a contingency remedy for thermal or something else, where you are unsure, but there needs to be clear, designation for when that preferred remedy, fails and when that contingency remedy is taken over. So that's another type of decision document. And then the last type I wanted to talk about is more the adaptive management action rod. And this really occurs when you're looking at a phase interim remedies with contingency remedies that really provide a formal process to achieve site cleanup goals and remedial action objectives. And this is really an approach for multiple components where you're looking at multiple technologies to get to the end of that cleanup. An example may be a source control for a soil, and then moving into the groundwater remediation and having a selection for instance, bio, and having a something in place if that fails, and then maybe at the end, going to M&A, but with an adaptive management rod, it's really important that the whole team agrees upon where's the data points, what are they going to be collected to show that you are completed with that first technology going to a next. So those are the ones I wanted to talk about. And I think they're all the ones I've talked about. And I just wanted to touch upon interim actions. So EPA, again, for groundwater remedies, a lot of times there may be an interim action done, and later on an M&A may take over. But Department of Energy has expressed support for the use of interim action rods, whereas more Department of War does not like interim rods and has a preference for final rods. So I just wanted to mention it really depends on the views for interim actions from that other federal agency. So I think that is it on my end, and I will turn it over for changing the remedy post rod. And I think that is that you, Jenna? Yep.
Yes.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Rashmi. All right. So sometimes the need arises to change a remedy for multitude of reasons. So post rod changes can come about for things such as maybe there's something in the document that just wasn't quite accurate that needs to be corrected, or maybe the remedy isn't performing as everyone thought it would, and there's some change needed to the remedy, or maybe there's just an increase in the amount of waste that's being produced, which increases the cost. So there's all sorts of different reasons. But the three types of rod changes are insignificant or minor, and then that's just documented with a memo to file. But it must be documented and included in the administrative record file so that there's a complete record for what was changed. The second type is, oops, sorry about that. The second type is a significant change, and this usually arises during implementation of the remedy where something has changed. As I said, something as far as how the remedy is operating, the success of that remedy, something needs to be changed within the confines of what was selected. And those significant changes require an explanation of significant difference be written. And then finally, if the team decides that the remedy that has been selected is not working at all, or there's some major reason why you have to then reevaluate what kind of remedy really will be effective, That's called a fundamental change. And those changes have to be documented in what's called a ROD amendment. So determine the type of post-ROD change is determined by the scope. Does the scope change? The performance, is there something about how the performance is of the remedy is working, and the cost. And again, for insignificant or minor changes, those are documented in a memo to file and included in the administrative record file. Examples include a change to the monitoring frequency or a small increase in the volume of waste. And look, I will give you a little example. So there was a remedy that was being implemented where there was a small increase in the volume of waste, requiring going from an estimated 60,000 cubic yards to 75,000 cubic yards of waste. But the estimated cost of the overall remedy will only increase by a small percentage. This may constitute an insignificant or minor change. So, changes which are significant but do not fundamentally affect the remedy selected in the ROD are issued as an explanation of difference. An ESD must describe to the public why the change is needed, the nature of the significant change, summarize the information that led to making the change, and affirms that the revised remedy complies with the NCP and the statutory requirements of CERCLA. Additional information regarding what's required in an ESD and what constitute an ESD, again, can be found in the 1999 ROD guidance that's been mentioned during this presentation. Generally, for an ESD, a new 9-criteria analysis is not required, but it is helpful to provide a side-by-side comparison of the original and the proposed remedy in order to clearly display the significant differences. Public notice is required and must be provided to the public in a media that can be accessed readily and becomes part of the administrative record file. A public meeting is not required. So here's a couple of examples. You have a large increase in the volume or cost associated with the remedy. So, for instance, sampling during the remedial design phase indicated the need to significantly increase the volume of contaminated waste material, substantially increasing the cost of the remedy. The change is significant, but not fundamental. Another example is the lead agency decides to use a biological treatment method instead of air stripping, which was identified in the ROD, for treatment of the extracted groundwater. The basic pump and treat approach remains unaltered, and the cleanup levels in the ROD remain the same and will be met by the alternative technology. But there is a change in the actual treatment method of the groundwater. So that is because it's retained as a pump and treat method, but it's just treating has a different modem or modality. That is a significant change, but not a fundamental change. So, ROD amendments. When a fundamental change is made to the remedy selected in the ROD with respect to scope, performance, or cost, the portion of the ROD that's amended has to go through what's called a ROD amendment with a new 9-criteria analysis, including new ARARs and demonstration that it meets the NCP. This entails the issuance of a revised proposed plan that highlights the proposed changes, and it provides this comparison. The focus of the amendment should be to document the rationale for the amendment and provide assurances that the remedy satisfies the statutory requirements. According to NCP 300.430, Components of the remedy not described in the ROD must attain or waive requirements that are identified as applicable or relevant and appropriate at the time the amendment to the ROD is completed. Remedial design and remedial action activities being conducted on other portions of the site or at other OUs not proposed for changes may continue during the amendment process. When fundamental changes are proposed to the ROD, the lead agency must conduct public participation and documentation procedures as specified in the NCP 300.435 and 300.825, which includes a public comment period on the proposed plan. Given the changes proposed are fundamentally different from the original remedy, the public has the opportunity to provide comments that were not considered in the original ROD. And here's a couple of examples. The first example is a change in the primary treatment method. The in-situ soil washing remedy selected in the ROD proves to be infeasible to implement after testing during the remedial design. A decision is made to fundamentally change the remedy to excavate and thermally treat the waste. Another example is during a 5-year review for a small industrial site, tests indicate that the containment remedy will not be protective, and now a more active response approach, for example, treatment, is necessary. A new remedy must be selected that will meet the protectiveness requirements. This will also increase the cost. And then, as just in one additional example, if you're performing, say, like a groundwater pump and treat type of remedy, and you haven't anticipated discovering additional contamination, but during this process, additional contamination, including DNAPL, is identified. Because the treatment of DNAPL, the DNAPL zone, is impracticable from an engineering perspective, rather than try to treat that source material with the pump and treat system, a decision is made to implement a containment approach or a slurry wall to contain the DNAPL zone. Even though pump and treat will continue outside the containment zone, because there is a new scope, performance, and remedy, it is a fundamental change, and therefore a ROD amendment must be completed. And that's it. And I will turn it back over to, I believe it's Aaron, for the 5-year review.
Yeah, it's 5-year views, and I'm actually in the middle of three of them right now. So, perfect topic at three of my sites. Here we go. So, statutory requirement in 5-year views, and I think I mentioned earlier, 5-year views came about as part of SARA. It's one section 121C of CERCLA. So, there's a few different types. There's three different types. There's statutory, if it is a post-ROD 5-year review, a post-SARA 5-year review that leaves waste in place, then it is a statutory 5-year review. If it is a, this is hypothetical, if it's a post-SARA ROD, that is just hypothetically, there's no groundwater contamination, not waste isn't going to be left in place, it's just a groundwater cleanup. Those 5-year reviews, but those that time it's going to take a while to clean up that site, those are policy reviews. And then also pre-SARA RODs for the site, if that's the only ROD that's in place, that those are also policy RODs. Then there's also discretionary that can be done at any times, but those are definitely few and far between. And at a federal facility, for federal facilities, the lead agency, which is not the EPA, would conduct a review and prepares the reports and submits the report to EPA for review and comment. EPA will either concur on the preliminary determination or provide independent findings, and part of the review process, it should go through the state on the private side. They're a required review of these 5-year views also. They'll get the draft and then the final also. And then another item on the 5-year view. The lead agency is responsible for ensuring that the recommendations and follow-up actions in the report are completed. And that is one thing at EPA is tracked, and definitely reminders are sent out to say, how is this issue and recommendation being addressed? There we go. And there's the 5 different protectiveness determinations. The 5-year review is determining, is the remedy still protective? The best one that we like to see is it protect it's protective. There's no exposure pathways. There's nothing in there that we don't think it's not going to be protective. There's no and so there's no issues and no recommendations. Another one, depending on where you start and where you are with your construction of the remedy, there's a chance that you could just say, because the trigger action for a, sorry, you could say it's going to be protective because the triggering action for now for a statutory 5-year review is the on-site construction. So that's taking longer than 5 years to complete. You're probably going to say, and you're constructing the remedy still, you're probably going to say, hey, the remedy is going to be protective. Next is protectiveness in the short term. But there's some items that could affect the protectiveness in the long term. That's when there is an issue and recommendation noted that needs to be addressed to determine how that protect about the protectiveness. So if there is an issue and recommendation, you're at least one of these, you're at least short-term protective. Next is not protective. That's if is there some exposure that you're looking at, the unknown exposure, or sorry, is there a known exposure there that's not, the remedy isn't protective? And that might trigger what Jenna got into earlier regarding a ROD amendment or something else to consider that you're going to have to do. And then lastly, if there's not enough information, the protectiveness can be deferred until that information is known. But with that, you need to have a specify the time frame. And then a ROD amendment is also required. I'm sorry, not a ROD amendment. A 5-year review amendment is then required to address the deferring of the protectiveness. And just helpful components, because think about it, you're kind of looking back at the REOs and exposure and contamination, kind of what's the media, the path, the risk, what are those risk drivers, what are those COCs, what are those cleanup levels? Kind of has the land use changed? Are there new residential buildings nearby? And then what's that purpose of the action? Are you preventing the exposure? Are you eliminating the release? You're restoring groundwater beneficial use. And this kind of get, I kind of just give some examples of remedies that are not considered protective. They're not going to meet the cleanup levels. Someone's being exposed. And kind of, I mentioned this earlier, if it's not, if a remedy is not protective, you're going to need an ESD or ROD amendment. If it's not protective in the short term. And then you're going to have to deal with them. And then kind of moving out of the 5-year review realm, but into the kind of the end of the Superfund process, even a site can be deleted if there's still waste in place, if the REOs are met, if ICs are in place, because operational maintenance can still be ongoing. So you would still have 5-year views. And realize site deletion is kind of, did you meet the cleanup levels? Did you meet the REOs? It's more of an administrative item, not a, it's not, it doesn't really, it's more, it changes it administratively. And realize and if you're going to delete a site, there's no further response that is appropriate that we know of at the time. And then I think like we there's the course summary, but I think we wanted to get into, is it questions now?
Yes, sir. This is J.R. Reynolds. I can go over some of the questions. No particular order. Let's see. If you have bad REOs, is your only option a Rod Amendment to fix them?
Sorry, the question was bad REOs is the only way to.
If you have bad REOs, is the only option a Rod Amendment to fix them?
I'm trying to understand the question if it's like a, if it's a, like how we're determining, how we're defining bad, if it's something that,
It really de it depends on what the remedial action objective is on the site. I mean, it's very site specific. If it's fail, you know, it's really hard generically to answer that question. But a lot of times, I know, you know, if there are remedial action objectives that are not met, an ESD or ROD amendment may have to be done because the remedy is not working, or and they may have to supplement that remedy. So it really depends on the what the remedy is and what the remedial action objectives are cited that in, you know, in the decision document. So Aaron or Jenna, you want to add anything?
I think yeah, it's very specific. I think there we would need more information on the question to really answer it. You're not
It is
just going
very
to change
site
how you
specific.
can. Yeah, it's very site specific of
And
what's really happening. Are you not meeting a standard? You're not going to meet that where the process is.
the person can reach out to any of our three panelists for
Yes.
clarification. Does the EPA define federal facilities to include only federal sites that are listed on the MPL? The need for a federal facility agreement and the EPA oversight role under EO 12580?
Yeah, I mean, so a federal an NPL site for a federal facility is one that's listed on the national priorities list, and that's based on the hazardous ranking system. If it's listed on the site, that's a preliminary assessment site inspection. So yes, it has to be listed on the NPL in regards to be a in regards to being a Superfund site. And then there are federal facility agreements for each site, each specific site, and each lead agency. So, you know, there could be DOE, DOW. So they're very site specific information in each federal facility agreement. Jenna, you want to add anything to that?
I just want to say we do have occasionally, we do have a federal facility which we don't have an FFA for, but we are working towards getting an FFA. It doesn't mean that we don't stop acting in our role as regulators. Irregardless, it's just the FFA is helpful because it really defines the scope of the responsibilities of all three parties and the requirements of, you know, what's going to be implemented.
All right, the next question is, when does the clock start ticking for the TCRA? After the AM?
So generally, yes, the regulations aren't super specific. They provide for, you know, the 6 month, there's the 6 month deadline that defines whether it's non-time critical or time critical. There's the 30-day public comment period, and that 30-day public comment period starts when the action memo or when the ECA is provided for public review. So once it's placed in the ARF, that's been administrative record file and repository, that starts the 30-day comment period. And I think there was a question too about whether that affects the time for when the action has to start. Again, I think the comment period needs to be completed prior to that time limit, but it's not a hard and fast rule in the regulations. It's sort of negotiable. As far as, you know, what clock starts when and what's included in that clock.
All right. Awesome. Thank you. This is kind of a three-part question, so we'll try to tackle it and see what happens. Which is the question: what happens when the EPA and the lead agency disagree on the protectiveness determinations in the 5-year review?
So, Donna, do you want to answer that one?
And then the same goes what happens when the state also or the EPA doesn't agree.
I think, a lot of that may be defined in the federal facility agreement. And then, it all comes down to milestones. So if you have an action where you have a deadline to either implement that action or to complete an action or to meet a certain remedial action objective, then if those things are missed, then that's subject to dispute and to federal facility enforcement.
So there is, if the lead agency and EPA disagree, the EPA RPM can do an independent determination and right, so that occurs a lot of times on federal facility sites. Just wanted to mention that. Aaron, did you want to say
Yeah,
anything?
no, I think you nailed it for
Good
the
point.
independent determination from the EPA side, but then for the state side, yeah, the state, what well, it's not a concurrence on the 5-year review. It's kind of like a review. EPA doesn't have to address the comments and move forward with it. Well, there'll be some back and forth and discussion of what we're doing and why, but it's not like a ROD from a EP, the state is concurring on a 5-year review. It's more, hey, you're helping with the review, you're helping with the process. This is what we think. Do we have an agreement? Are we in agreement?
Yeah, and I would just add also, if there's an objective that you feel is not being met at the site, like some cleanups, not action doesn't, EPA determines it's not protective, you can negotiate with the federal agency, the lead federal agency, to put a new milestone into your FFA that says this particular site or this particular problem will be addressed, and here's how we're going to address it, and here's our deadline. So that's kind of how you can move forward on something like that, is really, working through that FFA process.
And there's also, I mean, if there's not enough information or data, that's another option. Then you could, the protectiveness can be deferred until that data is collected. So I just wanted to mention that scenario as well.
And speaking of deferred, that was the third part of this question was, is it possible to have protectiveness deferred more than once on a DOE DOD site?
More than once, yes, I mean, that's a possibility that can occur. I mean, I think it's clear that there has to be some milestones and dates that are included in the 5-year review. And but that is a possibility that could happen. I mean, it could be it could happen twice. And yes, but I think it's clear then to really provide the recommendations that are needed with appropriate timelines so that it doesn't keep on being not protective. I don't know if Aaron, Jenna, you want to add anything?
I mean, I think it should be in that within that time frame, so that you find the information that you wouldn't have to defer, because it's not a you're not making it. If you're deferring the protectiveness, you're not make doesn't have to become protective. It just you need an answer. So
You need to
I don't.
understand what needs to be
Yeah, so I don't
completed.
think it shouldn't take 5 years to figure that out, but that is in the Aaron world. So we'll. I mean, this is the real world though.
And so just switching a little bit to a different area, how is a early action ROD different than implementing a TCRA?
So I think I put that in the chat. So a time critical removal action, an OSC has to make that determination, and it is more imminent. And the removal action memo has to be completed, while a early action ROD, an RIFS, is not completed, but that information and data should be included in the ROD so that it's part of the administrative record. So a ROD has to be done. Whereas, and that's something that a remedial project manager would handle versus an OSC.
Yeah.
Jenna, you want to answer any you had anything?
Sure. And another difference is a time critical removal action can be taken at the lead agency's discretion. They don't have to have regulation or regulator approval. A ROD does require regulator approval and signature.
Good point.
Where are operable units defined in the ROD or another decision document?
It It should you
It
have
should be
that
in the
one
rod.
portion of the that has it in the rod.
Yep, it should be in the
Let's
rod.
find the rod.
Okay, this is the question's incomplete, but we'll try it. What about PFAS? Is that enough to force a new rod?
So I see this one. I can answer it. So potentially, so if there's like if they, you'd have to look at how PFAS is impacted by that current remedy in place. If you have like a hypothetical situation, if you have a pump and treat site that has a treatment train that can treat PFAS, and it's being captured and dealt with, it potentially could only be a new ESD. So it's going to be very site specific of what's that nature and extent, how are you going to address it, and what you have now.
And is it site specific? Is it site specific?
And this
Yeah.
question is probably. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes, if it's yes, if it is if it's related to the site, EPA can't take action at Superfund sites for background.
This question happened on earlier. Do those models also include risk assessment calculations? I'm trying to figure out where that was
I did not
tied.
understand that. Like, I wasn't
That
sure
was in
what.
relation to the QAP guidance, like
Yeah.
how
Oh.
actually have and
Yes. I think the answer is yes. Anything that generates any type of information that may be used to make decisions at your site needs to be covered under the QAP. So, yes, it would include the risk assessment.
perfect. Let's see. Other moderators, feel free to jump in. I'm just trying to. Are 5-year reviews required for IROD only O use operating units? Not sure if that.
It's going to be dependent on the rem exact interim rod. So potentially, what it would depend on what the remedy components are, where's the waste, what are you actually doing? And the interim rod is going to have to be contingent. Should if there is an interim rod, it needs to be will need to be fit in with the final rod.
Yeah, it has. There has to be. I was going to say there has to be a final rod. For long-term protectiveness, yeah.
And I would say as long as there's waste in place above UUEE, like Aaron was talking about earlier, regardless of whether it's a removal or an IROD or what it is, the 5-year review still applies to
Even
ensure
if a
that,
site, yeah, even if a site's
yeah.
deleted.
Okay, we're gonna go back to PFAS again. The gift that keeps giving. If the PFAS is in a different area of the site, it would create a new operable unit. Is that a whole new rod?
If it creates a new operating, yeah, it probably would be a whole new rod. But I mean, it all
It
depends on
depends.
that.
It kind of
It's all that
depends
site
on,
specific of how it's set up.
it
So.
depends if it's site wide or is it in the, you know, where it is on the site. It could be a separate operable, you know, it kind of depends. It could be.
All right. I don't know if it's possible to answer this in, 2 minutes less, but are there good in quotation rods that we can try to emulate?
Well, that was when I answered on my thing, the ones I write.
Just email Aaron.
It's going to be following the 1999 guidance and following the NCP is the, and it's going to be very determinant on the rod. I don't think there's one that we're going to call out and say this is the greatest.
Yeah, no, the guidance document is really good. They're of course, you know, in the re you can talk to your senior RPMs and ask in the regions, you know, which rods they, you know, do they view. You can talk to headquarters, the regional, you know, the federal facility coordinators and get their advice. But really, the 1999 guidance document is really great. There's templates also, which are, you know, which kind of identify the sections and then what should be included. So that's another option, but I would say and talk to your colleagues who, the more experienced colleagues who have written a number of rods or reviewed a number of rods, to reach out to them as well. That's what I would say.
All right, I believe that I really think that is it, because any other questions here probably require more than 2 to 3 minutes. So I think at this time, I'm gonna turn it over to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much, JR. And I'm going to swap out the view of materials here and walk through just a few final closing reminders. But before I do so, I wanted to thank each of our three fantastic presenters. So, Gemma, Rashmi, Aaron, thank you so much for your time and expertise today. You did a fabulous job on that rapid fire Q&A period and presenting a lot of content on our session today. I also want to thank the support staff who joined me in the background today. As we've been hinting at on some of the most recent Clouin webinars, I am transitioning over to a new position here at EPA, so I will no longer be on these sessions. And you all will be joined by a fantastic group of individuals such as JR, Ray, and Shelley, who have been on helping to run today's session. So I want to thank the three of them for stepping up to help make today's session a possibility.
And
And
we
with
want to
that,
thank you, Jean. Thanks for
thank
being
you.
on this last session. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. It was a privilege. And of course, I want to be sure that all of our audience has their final questions answered before we close things out today. I did see a few basic questions in the Q&A asking if copies of the presentations will be shared. We actually posted the updated version of the slides just shortly after we got things started today. So, as was noted at the start, I'll show it here in just a moment. On the seminar homepage, there's a section where you can download a PDF copy of the presentation materials. We do not share written copies of all of the questions that were read out loud and responded to. However, this session was recorded and you'll be able to replay the full session, including the Q&A periods that we've had, so that others will be able to get the benefit of the full transfer of knowledge. And I'll walk through all of those reminders here in just a second. So the first reminder I have is that I encourage everybody to keep visiting us at the Cleanup Information Network or Cluin.org. And please be sure that you are a subscriber to TechDirect, which is our free monthly newsletter that I send out on the first of each month and will highlight free online training sessions such as today's FRTR, for me, Federal Facilities Academy session. The unique seminar homepage that was created for today's session is shown on this slide in the red URL. You can access it through the QR code as well. That website is available from today forward. That means you can bookmark it, you can save it, you can share that link with other people. It's the same site you went to when registering, it's the same place you went to when checking in, and it's the same place where I'll be sending you to now after the live event. There are sections on that site that if you scroll up and down, you'll be able to access information about our speakers, access copies of the presentation materials, access related websites and guidance documents that were discussed. And most importantly, there is a link to the online feedback form for today's session. Because one of the most common questions that the new team is going to face, as I learned over my years here working on webinars, is participants asking if they can get a copy of the certificate of participation. We do not issue PDHs or CEUs. However, we can provide you with a certificate of participation if you fill out the online feedback form. So make sure you visit the seminar homepage again through the QR code or the URL shown in red, fill out the feedback form, and check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you are here for the entire live delivery. Once you fill out that form and submit it, you'll then have access to download or print out a certificate. I'll even email a copy to you, but sometimes those get caught up in junk or spam filters, so I usually encourage people to download it from that confirmation screen when they see them. If you hosted a watch party, and from the stats that I see, there were a handful of you who had others joining with you at your location. If you were the one who registered, I encourage you to share the link to that seminar homepage to others who joined you in the room, and each person can fill out the feedback form, even if you didn't register on your own, to get your own certificate. So again, share the link. We want to get feedback. We do read each and every comment that you share, and we use those to improve future deliveries. So that seminar homepage is all important, and it is where we will post again links to the recorded version of today's session. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce the recorded archive and post it on the Cluin website, and you'll automatically get an email when that archive is available. You're welcome to forward that to other interested parties so that they can watch it, and you can still submit feedback based on replaying the recorded version to get a certificate of participation. So if you are one of the lucky ones watching the recorded version of today's session, right above my head in the recorded version, you'll see some buttons that will take you to that seminar feedback form. Go ahead and fill it out, check the box to say you watched the whole archive, and you'll get your own certificate for your own records. So with that, it is my pleasure to say thank you to each and every one of you one more time. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you will join the new team on a future Clue and webinar. With that, I'll formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.